Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. I'm Len Testa, your host. This is our first show for March 2015, and if you, like us, are currently buried in snow, then not to worry. We're going to take you to sunny Seven Seas Lagoon for the next half hour or so. That means that we need to hand over the show to our tame co-host. Some say his wit can be used as a de-icer on airplane wings. Others claim that he can stay outdoors in cold weather because the hair on his arms is actually goose down. All we know is he's called Jim Hill. Welcome to the show, Jim.
I have to see who's making these claims, all right? I admit that I do fly south, but that I use a plane, not goose wings. So
that's right. So this is our first March show. We're getting ready to head down, you and I, actually, together.
That's right.
To Walt Disney World in a few days.
And we are going to be checking out the new sites. And among the new sites at Walt Disney World right now are the Bora Bora bungalows.
That's right, the Polynesian.
You folks may have heard of these. These are 22-bedroom structures that have been built along the shore of the Polynesian Village Resort. These are Disney Vacation Club buildings. I guess they made them available to DVC members for purchase back in January, and the general public could get in on buying into them, I guess, in February. And near as I can figure, what is it? They're saying April 1st is when they're at least the first that are going to be open to the public?
Something like that, yeah. So beginning of April, yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, look, anybody who's been following this project knows that there's this kind of a controversial aspect of the bungalows, that there's a number of people who view these DVC units as it's kind of a naked cash grab. I mean, more to the point, they built these bungalows, you know, right down by the water at Seven Seas Lagoon. And for a lot of people, you know, it blocks this view of the Magic Kingdom that they'd loved for years. And, and it seems like Disney's favoring a deep pocketed few over the millions of guests who've gone to the Poly and visited there since October of 71. But for me, I mean, you know, the whole bunch, you know, the people that love who say that Walt would never have done, you know, that never would allow this, never would have done anything like this. But to be honest, I'm not entirely sure about that because, look, the people who work directly with Walt, like for example, former chairman of Walt Disney Attractions, Dick Nunes, once proposed building a set of honeymoon cottages right at the edge of Seven Seas Lagoon. Mind you, this was back in 1982, and this was for the original version of the Grand Floridian.
Really? It had honey cottages.
Yeah. They felt it was servicing a need that Disney, a market that Disney was interested in getting into, and obviously the company circled back around to this idea with Disney Weddings and the Wedding Pavilion, but in 82, this was a new thing. And more to the point, this was Dick's way of trying to figure out how to make use of a site for a hotel that Disney had actually had standing in place since the resort opened in 71, right there along the monorail track. But I'm getting ahead of myself here.
Okay.
To explain how we wound up with a Grand Floridian that wound up with Vacation Villas building and the Wedding Pavilion next to it rather than the set of honeymoon cottages, we really have to go back 50 years, which was when Walt and the Imagineers were first sussing out their original, you know, master plan for Walt Disney World, trying to figure out what elements would go where.
So this was 1965, which doesn't sound like it was 50 years ago, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's the strangest part. I mean, November of 65, when they hold that first public press conference for Project Florida, a lot of the major decisions have already been made about what to do with this 43-square-mile parcel of swampland and cattle pasture. We've already settled on where the East Coast version of Disneyland should be built, which means that they have to build this 7-mile-long north-south road, now known as World Drive, through, you know, I mean, really treacherous swamp. I remember talking with Bill Justice about when they would go out and visit the site, and it took them at that time with the little road that had been carved through the swamp almost 3 hours to get in, getting off of I-4, parking the car, getting in the heavy, you know, and just trolling their way to the swamp till they finally got to the kingdom.
Two and a half miles an hour they're averaging.
It was that bad.
Wow.
You know, and in fact, that was one of the reasons why the first things that were built at Walt Disney World was a network of 55 miles worth of canals just to to divert the water and to try to make the turf easier to travel past. But again, at the top of this road was where they're going to put the transportation center and the massive parking lot. They decided at that point pretty much to leave Bay Lake as it is, or where it was, excuse mm-hmm. me. But in order to give Disney World plenty of waterfront property to build around, they decided to build a man-made lake to the southwest of the kingdom that would then be called Seven Seas Lagoon.
So Seven Seas Lagoon wasn't there. It is entirely man-made.
Absolutely. Huh. And in fact, what's interesting is that the land that they used to haul, because again, remember, this is all basically at low-level swampland. Now, mind you, Seven Seas Lagoon is only, depending on where you're in the lake, it's 9 to 14 feet deep. Not a terribly deep waterway. But the soil that they hauled out is actually what they used to raise the Magic Kingdom work site far enough up so they could then do the utilidors and not have them flood. That's the thing that I think a lot of people don't understand about the Magic Kingdom, that when you're walking around the theme park, you're actually in the third floor of the building, that below you are this network of tunnels and supply places where costumes and electronics and things are kept. But that's all you're standing on what used to be the bottom of Seven Seas Lagoon. All of that was that soil was hauled out and piled up on the Magic Kingdom work site. But but as they're doing this, the reason they're doing this is that they wanted to build some resorts around Seven Seas Lagoon. And the shape of the lagoon changed a number of times between 65 and 67, as did the assortment and the arrangement of resorts that were going to be built along the shores. I mean, when Walt was alive, the plan was to build two coves that sort of faced across each other from the water. There was going to be, and in this version of the Disney World master plan, one of the coves was actually going to be a faux version of Cape Cod Bay, and you were going to be able to stay in this resort that was themed to early America. I'm sorry, for me, living in New England.
Yeah, there's no appeal at all.
Well, just the holy, honey, we got to get downstairs for the 3 o'clock witch lynching. Come on.
There's scurvy on the menu tonight.
I don't know as I would have been that excited about, ye old, don't forget to leave the resort with, you can't go out without a hat that has a buckle on it. On the other hand, directly to the north across Seven Seas Lagoon, they were going to build this South Seas-themed cove where Walt wanted to build this Tahitian-style resort, which, again, Walt would never have done that. It's like, well, oddly enough, the Tahitian-themed resort was supposed to have featured waterfront units that were very much like the Bora Bora bungalows that have just been built at the Polynesian Village.
Really?
Yeah. That's kind of the theme of the Walt Disney Company, that a good idea never really dies.
Yeah.
But that said, Walt himself did die in December of 66. And with his passing, the master plan began to mutate. Seven Seas Lagoon slowly got larger and larger as the Imagineers began exploring ideas of building this series of waterfront resorts that would then have primo views of the Magic Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the contemporary of the Polynesian Village people know. But the other three themed resorts that the Imagineers wanted to build in and around Seven Seas Lagoon during the first 5 years of the Walt Disney Resort was open to the public, these aren't as well known. So let's start with the Venetian, which was going to be built within walking distance of the Ticket and Transportation Center. It's on that spit of land, the water bridge that you go under to go to, toward the Kingdom and the Contemporary.
Yeah.
Off to your left there, you can see it from the monorail. It's a kind of this rounded spit of land. This elaborately themed resort featured a small enclosed boat harbor that fed into this intricate system of waterways. And so, yes, if you and your significant other wanted a romantic gondola ride in the canals while you're staying at this resort, you could do that. As for the hotel itself, it was supposed to be kind of modeled after St. Mark's Square. The entire lobby was going to be glass-topped, this beautiful sunlit atrium. In fact, if you've ever been in the Renaissance Orlando Resort, the one that's across from SeaWorld, that they have that beautiful, massive central atrium, that's the effect Disney was going for. I mean, really? The sort of sun-drenched, you know, and the rooms all faced into the inner corridor, but had windows looking out to the parks. It was going to be amazing. And just in case you're wondering, yes, when Disney finally decided to build an Italian pavilion at Epcot Center as part of that park's World Showcase, the Imagineers did go back to the files and dust off the original plans for the Venetian Resort. And a lot of the detail work that you see as you wander around that World Showcase pavilion is cribbed from the 1969-1970 architectural plans that Walton Beckett and associates drew.
Oh, it's a Walton Beckett. They did the World's Fair stuff and the contemporary.
That's it, exactly. Again, this is the Los Angeles-based architectural firm that, you know, a lot of people now, it just seems kind of bizarre that Disney would farm out, you know, the design of its hotels to an outside firm. But you have to remember that the Imagineers prior to Walt Disney World had never designed hotels. They'd done attractions and rides and shows and theme parks, and they would come up with the general theme and concept. But when it came to where do we put back of house, you know, how do we do elevators, that sort of thing, they didn't have the expertise for that. It was only in the mid-1980s when Michael Eisner set up the Disney Development Company, which was specifically designed to do resorts.
And Walton Beckett's been doing, at this point, it's the mid-60s, Walton Beckett's been doing hotels for 30 years.
That's it, exactly. So, and more to the point, they, like you said, they had the relationship with Disney. It actually came out of the 64 World's Fair. And speaking of Walton Beckett design stuff, it's like, now let's head north at the Contemporary.
Oh, so sorry, real quick. Sorry. So this, as people listen to this, it's helpful to go look on Google Maps. Mm-hmm. At this, but that strip of land is the single largest piece of undeveloped land around Seven Seas Lagoon. From the TPC through to the Contemporary, that's a piece of land that is at least as large as what Disney has for the Grand Floridian. Now, maybe not including parking. Maybe it's the size of the... It's definitely larger than the size of the Polynesian with parking. I think the issue they would run into there, though, is... So the way that the monorail is built is that the monorail, as you're going around the monorail clockwise... Mm-hmm. Around the Magic Kingdom resorts, the monorail to the left of the monorail is most of the parking and infrastructure support. But for that strip of land, there is only this tiny, tiny strip of grass between the monorail and World Drive. It's not large. It's definitely smaller than any of the Polynesian parking lot. It'd be difficult to put a parking lot on the left side of the monorail there. They'd be taking some of the prime real estate from that section of land. But you can even see though where they've put sort of canals along that section where, you know, if they needed to access water inside of the land from Seven Seas Lagoon, they could do that there.
You know, in fact, you're right. It's this primo piece of property. In fact, during the Eisner era, there were no less than two different tries at doing a Mediterranean style resort in that space than, in fact, you know, if you Google Mediterranean Resort, you know, some of the imagery that they've got, the white form core model and some other work that was done for it, it's pretty spectacular.
Huh.
But the problem is they found out this section of Seven Seas Lagoon, when they did test pilings in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. To go forward with, you know, building resort there, they just went straight down.
Ugh.
You know, they found out the hard way that they had built over... you know, sort of an incipient sinkhole. And so, you know, the weird thing is every, you know, couple of years, you will see Disney circle back to this piece of real estate because obviously it's beautifully placed. In fact, you know, if you compare the Venetian Resort, which was this really sort of square building, mm-hmm. With the Mediterranean, they had begun with the hope of actually being able to use the land instead of building up, building out, spreading out and keeping it relatively low profile and trying to spread the weight around with the hope that they could then build. But again, the test pilings that they drove into the ground just disappeared. And so it is an idea that every 5 or 6 years or so, Disney kicks the tires on, and they keep a very close eye on what's going on with construction techniques in the industry. And if someday somebody figures out how to put a resort in that spot. In fact, this was at one time where they, remember how we talked about that they were looking to do a 200-room Magic Kingdom Suites hotel, this was that spot, you know.
200 rooms is not large at all. That's a quarter of the size of the Polynesian. I mean, that's not you could put that on pretty much anywhere around Seven Seas Lagoon without without too much trouble.
Well, the idea with that hotel is that it would be like basically you were staying in Toontown. I mean, you know, you had, you know, enormous, cartoon-like doorknobs for the rooms,
right,
and Mickey hands to hold the towels up in the bathroom. And I mean, it was, you know, if you were a Disney fan, this was the hotel you wanted to stay on. But at the same time, the notion was that, you know, even if we put a 200 room all suites hotel on that spot, you know, at least we're finally using the real estate. But even then, you know, that just, you know, the engineers did out and did the weight tests, and it's like, no, you know, nobody wants to stay in the Mickey Hotel and, you know, end up staying in the subterranean Disney resort, you know, just sort of like, you know, on the upside, they could have, I guess, themed that one around Atlantis.
you know, and Disney has this history of doing underwater hotels in its attractions, right? They totally could have done that. Hey, so real quick, just to divert for a second, some of the big news that came out in the past couple of weeks is that the Walt Disney World Speedway is closing.
Speaking of
prime real estate, I mean, that is the section. That by itself is the size of all of Seven Seas Lagoon. When you take a look at the Magic Kingdom parking lot, but the Speedway itself is the size of the Grand Floridian's entire site. Is that all going to be parking, you think, or you think they're going to?
Well, all right. Here's the hard reality. The expansion of the Magic Kingdom. You know, with the adding of New Fantasyland, you know, they're now very comfortably putting an additional 5,000 people into that park without breaking a sweat. In fact, what's kind of interesting now is, particularly over this last holiday period, you know, typically when Disney would do a phased close of the theme park, I mean, one of the first warning signs that, you know, hey, we should probably be closing the park is the parking lot filled up.
Right.
You know, and it's like, okay, you know, we can't put any more people in the parking lot. We should probably close the park. What happened this holiday period is they changed to a new footing. You know, they literally, when the parking lot closed, they would then direct people to, at the toll plaza, to like turn around, go to Epcot, get on the monorail, take the monorail over to TTC, transfer there to the Magic Kingdom monorail, and come on over to the parks. And, you know, just it was one of these things where it kept the park operational,
It was inconvenient to guests, I get it.
Yes. And so this is kind of staring down the barrel of the fact that, you know, look, when they built the Speedway, the notion was that this wasn't just going to be where you went to do the Richard Petty driving experience. I mean, this was actually a place where races were staged, for at least for a couple of years.
That's where I did a couple of events. There's a tri-oval. It's a decent track. I mean, I've been on it.
Yeah. You know, in fact, what is it? It's the park, the track officially opened in January of 96. And what ended up happening, a couple of things bit them in the butt. First of all, again, they had this situation where when they held events, the race fans wanted the park close to the racetrack. So again, same operational issue.
Mm-hmm.
They had to send the guests over to park at, you know, the people who were going to the Magic Kingdom for the day, ended up parking Epcot and driving over. And that turned out to be not a great guest experience. They got a lot of complaints about it. So the very next year they swapped. They told the race fans that, look, you're going to have to park at Epcot and come on over. You know, we'll bus you there. And, of course, classic Disney, they didn't have enough buses available, and it turned out to be this big magilla. That on top of the fact that when they held race events, you have to remember, you know, if you've been to Daytona or if you've been to any of the big tracks and seen a big race, they're loud, all right? And what Disney found on race day as well as qualifying days around the event, they got so many complaints from guests who were staying at, particularly Wilderness Lodge, but the Poly.
Really, at the Wilderness Lodge? Oh, yeah, because the long straightaway faces the Wilderness Lodge.
There you go. And so you found, you know, they found they were doing a lot of guest recovery because people are like, I am staying in, you know, I came to Wilderness Lodge because I love the quiet and the peace of the woods. You know, it's like, and that was just a lot of meals and room nights to give away to make people happy. And that coupled with the fact that there was this horrible period where back to back, they had, in 97, they had, three different racers injured in kind of, you know, like in fact, Sam Schmidt was left paralyzed by a crash on, and it was one of these things where it's, Disney hadn't bought into that, you know, this whole notion of, well, wait a minute, people get hurt, you know, and there's noise and this, you know, it was one of these things by, And that coupled with the fact that they built this giant facility in the middle of their parking lot that they were getting such limited use out of, that was one of the reasons they cut the deal with Richard Petty, was to try to get it, to be used during the off season and at least, you know, have some sort of revenue stream coming in.
Right.
So it's really not a surprise given, what just happened over the holiday period that it's like, okay, you know, look. You know, we need the space back. So, that's going back to parking lot. And
the whole thing is going back to parking lot.
Because
that's gonna increase the size of the parking lot if they pave the whole thing by like 50%, 40%.
Yeah,
wow, but that's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people, but at the same time, there's been some discussion of, you know, again, this is Disney. It's like, you know, we're leaving money on the table. You know, could we maybe put a restaurant refreshment complex, some sort of thing, in the middle of the parking lot? Because, you know, God forbid you get tired or hungry while walking from your car to the tram.
Your blood glucose levels drop. You need a Mickey bar. I understand.
There you go. So, I mean, and remember, you know, when they do this, you will then see much the same as what they've just done in front of the Poly, sort of a repositioning, rethinking of the parking lot to create, you know, that much more space, for example, for, you know, drivers who are, or, you know, visitors who are willing to pay for primo up close parking. And
oh yeah, they'll have one, two, three, four different areas. Oh, you think there'll be premium parking?
Oh yeah, no, this is, you know, face it, this is the modern Walt Disney Company, and anything and everything is on the table as a revenue source. And, you know, that this has been a discussion for quite some time about, you know, creating a way for guests who want to pay that extra $5 or $10 to be parked right up close so they can just, you know, walk straight over the ticket transmit.
Do you know it's 0.8 miles from the back of the speedway to the TTC?
Yeah, you know, and again, when
that's a hike,
you know, when you're hauling that diaper bag, you know, just sort of like, I want to park up front.
So. Well, it's bigger than the Magic Kingdom side to side or end to end. All right. So they're not going to do anything to the south of the Polynesian around Seven Seas Lagoon. There's really only one other strip of land then. And that's sort of, between the Grand Floridian and the Magic Kingdom, right?
Well, yeah, and even there, you know, because you have, you know, back of house, you have the canal way, for example, that the water pageant comes out from.
This is the canal that everyone passes over on the monorail and thinks, why don't we have a walkway from the Grand Floridian to the Magic Kingdom? And this canal is the reason why.
Yeah. I mean, it just, in fact, I guess there were engineering tests and some drawings done up for a drawbridge type setup that would allow people to walk back to the flow. But, you know, again, the sad thing is if you see the water pageant boats, I mean, literally they're basically chicken wire.
It's true.
With Christmas lights.
Yep.
And in fact, I think that's
and
the thing.
And a chicken sound system.
Yeah. But, you know, Ron Mitzker, the guy who was in charge of entertainment, you realize those floats were only built for the opening. You know, there was a party that they held for guests and dignitaries, as part of the 3-day long official grand opening of Walt Disney World. They were built for the party that was being held in Luau Cove. And one night, kind of like what happened with the dragon at the opening of New Fantasyland.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the weird thing is the dragon was actually built to be a permanent attraction at the park, and the lawyer shut it down after one flight. It's like, you know, no, so $3 million out the window. But on the other hand, this chicken wire thing that was put together for one night, you know, for one show, has been running for what, 44, 45 yeah. years now?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I, honestly, you never know at Disney.
It's kind of cool. I mean, I've stayed at the Grand Floridian and seen it. I've stayed at, you know, the Contemporary Bay Lake Tower and seen it. And I don't want to sit and watch the entire thing, and I'm not going to make a special trip over to see it. But as it's going by, it really is kind of charming.
It is. It is. And don't get me wrong. They've upgraded it over the years. I mean, they've gotten better quality Christmas lights and chicken wire. But, you know, but it's still basically the same show.
Yeah. You pass by it, unless you really know what you're looking at, it sort of looks like barges. Right?
Yeah. You know, and I don't know. Again, just one of those things that you know, like you said, you know, you'll see it and you'll be standing there for 5 minutes and it's like, I've seen this before, but it's still just, you know, compelling entertainment.
It's like a light bright with the lights off. You're trying to figure out what the shape is. You know, it's like, that looks like it's something, but what is it? You know, and then you turn the lights on and you're like, oh, yes, I totally understand. So you think they're going to do anything with that strip of land? We're talking about something that's directly north of the Grand Floridian and west of the Magic Kingdom. And it is, I mean, just treed. There's nothing there other than canals. And it's about the size of the Grand Floridian.
Actually, oddly enough, I think the place that it's far more likely that we will see construction at some point in the future at where the Persian Resort was once supposed to be built. That's actually to the north of the Contemporary along the shores of Bay Lake.
Oh, okay. So directly, I was going to ask you about that. So that's the east of, if you were to walk all the way through Space Mountain and keep going.
Yeah. In fact, and what's kind of interesting is you've probably seen some art for this at some point in the past. It's, this is the Disney World Resort that was going to be laid out in a circle with jewel-like mosques and columns rising out of landscape courtyards. It was going to use a minimalist but really very distinctive blue and white color scheme. And the centerpiece of this the Persian Resort was supposed to be this entrance complex with this 24-foot tall dome on the top of it. I mean, very much, you know, the weird thing is you look at it and you think, that's Aladdin. I mean, you know, just the art direction of that 1992 Walt Disney Animation Studios film, you know, looks very much like this. But again, it's that look that we all know from the 1001 Arabian Nights, a very exotic Far Eastern palace. It was going to have these beautiful terrace sun decks and sculpted swimming pools and, you know, an old Persian dining experience. And, but here's the interesting thing. I only just came across this while I was doing the research for this story, that of the three themed resorts that were designed and never built around Seven Seas Lagoon and Bay Lake, the Persian actually came the closest to being built.
Really?
Yeah. And you're going to love this. It was because the Shah of Iran personally offered to fund the construction and then staff the hotel back in 78.
Oh, not a good time.
In fact, this is, you know, actually, Marty Sklar, the former head of Imagineering, backed up this story, okay? That the Imagineers are meeting with the Shah's representatives, and get this, Lynn, it's 1978, all right? Okay, and they're there to discuss the construction of an Iranian pavilion for the World Showcase. That's all they're there for.
Okay.
All right, and
at least
you know,
country. Okay, good.
All right, and you know that seems to be some sort of difficulty with students outside, but you know that they're still meeting.
Yeah.
And during these conversations, a member of the royal family actually asks about Walt Disney World's never built Persian resort. And it, you know, they say that it was a real shame that it was that it never went forward because if Disney World visitors had been able to stay at a hotel that had celebrated Arab culture, a place that showcased the history and the artwork of the region, mm-hmm. you know, maybe relations between the West and the Arab world would have been different. And so suddenly, you know, again, Marty and the guys are just there about the Iranian Pavilion, and suddenly this whole new door opens.
Right.
And so, you know, so they begin discussing, would you like to do the Iranian Pavilion and the Persian Hotel? And things actually get pretty far along. In fact, they're in the process. They've already flown over the model for the Iranian Pavilion. They have all the artwork ready to do the presentation to the Shah, and so he'll sign off on it mm-hmm. in February of 1979.
Oh. Bad timing.
Yeah, and so February 11th, 1979, the Islamic Revolution happens, the Shah gets overthrown, and the Iranian Pavilion and the Persian Resort both fall off the table. But this would not be the only time that you know, the Disney would have Arab world-related money troubles. That's actually what did in the Asian Resort, which was supposed to be built where the Grand Flow is now. And just to give sort of set the stage here, in 1970, Disney published what they called the Preview Guide for Walt Disney World mm-hmm. Resort, this handsome little booklet. In fact, I think D23 recreated it for one of their events. But anyway, in this booklet, the Asian Resort is designed as being strongly Thai in motif, with each of the 600 rooms that were going to be built at this hotel, including 500 elegant suites in royal Thai decor.
Wow.
They'd all look out on Seven Seas Lagoon or a central recreation area. And the central building of the Asian Hotel, which was sort of this picture, a four-sided building with kind of giant A-frame windows. And there was going to be a themed restaurant and lounge set at the very top of this 160-foot-tall building. And mm-hmm. This would be where they'd have nighttime dancing and a stage show. And, it really looked wonderful. And more to the point, again, from the same guide, that this was the plan, that in conjunction with U.S. Steel, which, remember, at this point, U.S. Steel is building the hotels for Disney, and they were actually going to operate the resorts for Disney. It was only in the January of 71 when U.S. Steel went to Disney and said, you know, those two hotels that you want to open in October, we're not going to be ready. That, you know, you should probably expect them not to be ready till 72. That's when Disney bought out U.S. Steel and took over running the hotels. At a time when the project is leaking money, they had to find this huge chunk of change to buy at U.S. Steel and make them go away. It was a scary, scary moment in the Walt Disney World project. To get back to it. So, in conjunction with U.S. Steel, we will open two resort hotels in our first year, the Contemporary Theme Hotel and the Polynesian Style, while the other hotels will be ready to meet the demand of our audience as experience dictates.
Mm-hmm.
I know, weird, vague corporate language. So.
Huh.
So, but anyway.
You think that area above to the north of the Contemporary is the next spot where a hotel would go?
Oh, it would have to be, Lynn. I mean,
because the thing directly above it is a... It's a plot of land that's about as large as the Contemporary facilities, not counting mm-hmm. Bay Lake.
Yeah.
And then above that, it looks like it's a parking lot. It's paved. It's like facilities that's, parking or something, right?
That's actually where, if you're looking at the ferries or the other boats that ply, that's your dry dock. That's, I mean, don't get me wrong. There would be challenges, because obviously you're moving into back of house areas. In fact, what's kind of interesting, if you go out and do the bass boat thing or the little, the water sprites, mm-hmm. Disney sits somebody out there, one of their sort of lifeguard security people in a boat. And if you get a little too close there, they will chase you away because this is back of house. They don't want you back there. So, this is, don't get me wrong. It would be a challenging piece of turf. Not the least of which the reasons would be that, you know, you'd have to widen. I mean, face it, that
World
section
Drive, that one section of World Drive is two lanes.
Yeah, and you know,
that's
just
a country road at that point.
It is. And let's be honest here, Disney's been staring down the barrel of that for quite a number of years now. That, you know, whether it's the two-lane road that rolls across the top of the parking lot, or again, Floridian Way, or this road, it's just sort of like, there are, you know, I mean, there are so many people who work for Disney now, and there's so many, you know, so much demand for the folks who are in those hotels or the buses or that sort of thing. It's just sort of like, they have to bite the bullet at some point, but it's a can that keeps getting kicked down the road. But I would, you know, that's honestly one of the reasons why they haven't developed this, this primo piece of real estate, is just the notion of, you've got to factor into the cost of building this resort, you know,
the roads and the maintenance and everything.
And think about it. You have to shut down the land bridge.
And
that's always been the artificial pinch point. And how, if you shut down the land bridge, you know, anybody who's staying at the campgrounds or Wilderness Lodge.
Oh, then they'd have to get off at the Contemporary and walk or something like that. And, then it's tedious. Huh. So let me okay, so I understand why that was. So they wouldn't be able to use the boats. Yeah, because that is two lanes, and they'd have to. You'd have to expand the tunnel that you go under the
Well, I mean, again, it's the reality. I mean, but at the same time, you know, you work the financials, and it's just sort of like, you know, Disney typically likes to be able to recover, to get return on investment within, I've heard, 3 to 5 years. Typically, if you can make it close, you know, that you've got total return on investment within 3.5 years, you're pretty much assured, you know, a green light on a project. And that's the problem. If you're going to build a resort there,
it'd have to be huge. And then but the larger you get, the more infrastructure problems you have. Mm. Huh. Interesting. What about, so real quick, what about, Bay Lake itself? So if you look at Bay Lake, you've got, it's essentially an equilateral triangle, right? A triangle with three legs the same size. One leg is Fort Wilderness and Wilderness Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
The other leg is Bay Lake Tower and the Contemporary with that piece of land we just talked about and then some infrastructure stuff. But there's this, entire strip of land that goes sort of north to east, and if you continued along it, you would hit the Four Seasons and the Tranquilo golf course. But there's nothing on it. It's the top edge of Bay Lake, mm-hmm. facing Discover. Why isn't anything there? Is it just too remote?
Well, transportation has always been an issue. That coupled with the fact that, part of the thing is that you're trying to sell people on the idea who are staying at Fort Wilderness, you know, that you're in a somewhat remote area. I mean, that's the theme.
Okay.
All right. In fact, you know, you and I have talked in the past about the DVC that's supposed to be built on top of, River Country. And in fact, you know, they just, you know, what was it, 3-4 months ago, did another set of height test balloons over there?
Yeah.
So that's back in the rotation. But, you know, as we discussed that, between the bungalows, that have just gone on sale for DVC and, that came on, that's coming online just after the villas at Grand Floridian. There's supposedly another set of at some point, we've talked about this off air. Can we talk about this on air or the?
Sure.
Okay. The next after the bungalows is the redo of, or changing out a floor or two at the Wilderness Lodge, right?
Yeah. So we're trying to figure out, you know, where the next set of, Disney Vacation Club properties is going to be. And the reason why we think there's going to be more is that, as we've talked about this on the show before, but, all of the sales of Disney Vacation Club get bundled into theme park revenue for the Disney Corporation. And it's a steady stream of money that Disney doesn't want to give up. Mm. Because the year that they stop, they'll show a drop in theme park earnings, and nobody wants to be CEO or nobody wants to be an executive anywhere on the executive committee when that happens. So they're sort of on this treadmill where they've got to keep building DVC resorts. The problem is building as we just talked about for the last half hour, building a whole new resort from scratch is hard, right? Yep. So absolutely. The easiest thing for Disney to do, and the thing that you've seen them do, you know, sort of lately, is expansion or conversion of an existing resort. So right now, the only deluxe resort on property that doesn't have rooms, DVC rooms, is the Yacht Club. So the thing that we've heard, we've heard there's going to be some activity at the Yacht Club. We've heard some activity at Wilderness Lodge, because Wilderness Lodge is insanely popular among the deluxe resorts. Mm-hmm. And then maybe circling back around the pod. But why don't you give people the timeline and sort of the details around that?
Well, okay. That's, again, we talked about the Wilderness Lodge redo. Okay. Again, you know, changing out this two sets of floors, supposedly.
So coming, like what they did at the Animal Kingdom Lodge.
That's it exactly. The, you know, that's the precursor to Kidani Village.
Right.
And which is kind of ironic when you think about it, because the Wilderness Lodge actually built the villas next door.
Yeah, they built an entire building, right.
Yeah, and so this is kind of, you know, a reverse of what they did over at Animal Kingdom Lodge. Then on the heels of that, as you discussed, we see Yacht Club.
Right. Well, I've also heard, though, it's there'll be honeymoon cabins.
Mm. That's right.
On Bay Lake.
And again, you know, just that's the irony is the very thing we talked about at the top of the show, that you know, Dick Nunes had wanted to do with the Grand Flow is finally resurfacing only over the Wilderness Lodge.
It's a mile away. It's close enough. I mean, let's face it.
You know, and then, if I remember correctly, we then circle back to the Poly, right?
Right. So Wilderness Lodge in villas, and then Yacht Club gets some room. Now, the thing that's interesting about the Yacht Club is the Yacht and the Beach Club together are some of the lowest occupancy resorts on property, and we, you know, for a variety of reasons, which we can eventually touch on, but by taking some of those rooms out of circulation, it automatically boosts the inventory because they'll become timeshare rooms, not regular hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that'll help them out. Plus, I think one of the reasons why people don't like the Yacht Club is because you can't get that one bedroom or two bedroom, or studio with a kitchenette or whatever for longer stays. So but then the idea is that they'll circle back to the Poly again, because I think the Poly is a gold mine, you know, and they've just started tapping it.
No, absolutely. Speaking of occupancy rates in the Poly, I mean, where do you hear this? This is from the 1972 Walt Disney Productions annual report. Okay, just to give you some idea of how successful Disney World was when it opened in October of 71. Since opening day, direct quote from the report, the demand for accommodations through Central Florida has exceeded the supply. On site are two theme resort hotels, the Contemporary and the Polynesian Village, operated at near 100% capacity. And between our two hotels and the Fort Wilderness Campground together, they hosted over 1.75 million guests. All right.
Wow.
Now, again, you're going to love this, okay? From the same report, just to give you some historical perspective here, the metropolitan Orlando area at that time, you know, that just prior to the opening of Walt Disney World, had only 5,850 hotel rooms. The reason that Len is laughing is, you know, if you combined all of the hotel rooms at the All-Star Music, the All-Star Sports, and the All-Star Movies together, all three of those, you have 5,760 rooms. So again, that's all of the hotel rooms that were available in 1971 in the metropolitan Orlando area. All right.
And now what, there's a quarter of a million. I mean, something insane.
But right from the get-go, that the same thing happened. That again, from the report in 72, that, you know, so they're reporting that, oh my God, look what's going on outside of our gates. That a total of 22,700 hotel/motel rooms have either been completed or under construction, and another 14,000 are due to be, you know, constructed in 1973. So like, oh my God, look what's going on outside the gate, you know. So
that was a construction boom. I mean, think about that. To go from 5,000 to what, by the end of that, it would be 41,000. So an 8 times increase.
Absolutely.
But then you need restaurants, you need roads, you need
everything.
And then you're going to draw in people, and then the people are going to need places to stay. I mean, just think about the construction boom that lasted throughout the 70s.
No, absolutely. And this is why, Disney admitted, looking at what was going on outside the gates, it's like, look, we recognize the public would always prefer to stay within the Vacation Kingdom site, which is why the company will soon begin architectural work on our third resort, the 500-room Asian Hotel. And now, what I find interesting is between 1970 and 1972, the Asian Hotel went from being a 600-room resort to a 500-room resort. And that was because Disney was hedging its bets, because it turns out it really is a small world after all. Case in point, the Yom Kippur War. Think about it.
Oh, yeah. Is that the Six-Day War?
October 7th, 1973. Syria and Egypt, with the support of several other Arab nations, launches a surprise attack on Israeli-occupied territories on Judaism's holiest day. And the U.S. immediately offers military support to Israel, and as a direct result of the United States getting involved in this conflict, 10 days after the Yom Kippur War begins, OPEC raises the posted price of oil by 70%. Now, mind you, it only went to $5.11 a gallon, all right?
A barrel.
But the very next day, OPEC ministers meet, and they agree to an across-the-board 5% cut in oil production from the previous month's levels. And they then threaten to cut oil production by 5% every month until their economic and political objectives are met. And as a direct result, between October of 73 and January of 74, world oil prices quadruple. They go from $3 a barrel to $12 a barrel.
Yep.
Okay, so this is the Arab oil embargo, and given at that time, three out of every four people who visited Walt Disney World drove down to the resort.
Yeah, it's right around that number right now. It's like 70%.
Is it really?
Yeah, still,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so the attendance levels crater, which is why January of 74, Disney actually lays off thousands of people, cutting back its workforce from 11,000 cast members to 9,000 cast members. Now Disney tries to put a brave face on this for the investment community. They insist that the people that they just laid off are seasonal employees who were hired to help out at the resort for the 73 holiday season. But given that Disney had seen an 8.9% drop in attendance between December 15th of 73 and January 6th of 74, not to mention that they'd seen a 4% drop in overall attendance at the park during the last quarter of 73, they're in crisis mode.
Yeah.
And so this is where it gets interesting, because nobody at this point knows how long the Arab oil embargo is going to last. And so the company is facing some real tough choices. Do they go forward with construction of a new hotel that they may not be able to fill, or do they build something that will then give people a compelling reason to actually drive down to Florida with the little gas that they can find, like, say, a state-of-the-art thrill ride like Space Mountain? And this was the choice. This was the Disney equivalent of Sophie's Choice. They had prepped the land. The site was ready. I mean, if you look at photographs from this period, that square piece of land with the Asian resort, I mean, it was ready, primed, ready to go. Not only that, the street in front of the hotel, I mean, the road you take from the car care center back to the service areas out behind the kingdom, already called Asian Way. I mean, you know, we're going to build this hotel. And in fact, they didn't change the name to Floridian Way till, 17 years later. I'm told it was this amazingly contentious board meeting.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, this is what? This is 72, 73?
Yeah, this is late 73.
Okay, so we're still in Vietnam.
Yep.
we've got this. That's the time. That's when the board of directors earns their money, right? Because you're in a hot shooting war in Southeast Asia. You've got this OPEC crisis. You've got Watergate.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not a really confident time for the country.
No, it's not. And they've got to make these decisions, right? They've got to figure out: are we going to invest, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in development?
And here's the thing, Glenn. You know what it came down to? They were already pouring concrete on Space Mountain. That was the deciding factor. That they
really?
Were pouring the foundation. You know, if the board had met a week earlier, you know, who knows what would have happened. But in the end, it came down to we're pouring concrete. All right. You know, just let's go with that. It's a thrill ride. We can promote it. And in the end, it seemed to be a smart choice. I mean, that you know, in fact, what's kind of interesting is if you look cold-bloodedly at Disney in the 70s going into the 80s, you know, yeah, they expanded the campground and you saw new wings being added to the Contemporary and things like that. And a couple of new longhouses at the Poly.
But they still all got the stuff from the early and mid-70s, but it's probably still right in their mind.
No, that's exactly. I mean, it's just front of mind. But at the same time, you saw the company betting on highly promotable attractions like Big Thunder Mountain.
Right.
Or more to the point, you saw that in order to fill the hotels that we have, we need, you know, we know not only one park, we need a second park. And that's where Epcot's going
to
come.
Oh, God, I would love to hear that. That's a great leading to that story. All right. We'll have to talk about that. Because, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, you know, we can't build a few hundred more hotel rooms because we're not sure what the economic environment is going to be like. On the other hand, they're essentially doubling down by a $1 billion investment in Epcot. I would love to hear what that board meeting was like with those board, because you know at that point not everyone could have been on board.
No, absolutely. But the interesting thing is they honestly believe that Epcot, you know, with the opening of Epcot, that would finally allow Disney to get back into the resort business. That they saw all the growth that was going on outside property. They knew they had 100% capacity to get all their stuff. So here it is, May of 1982, and we're 5 months away from the opening of Epcot. And Eyes and Ears, which is the cast member newsletter, newspaper, now magazine, that they made available. They sit down with Dick Nunes, who was then the president of Disney Outdoor Recreation, now what we call Parks and Resorts. And they, you know, the topic of expanding Disney's assortment of hotels comes up. And Dick's response is really interesting. He says, the estimates right now is that this area, Central Florida, is between 15,000 and 19,000 hotel rooms short. And we're worried about that. So we're planning to expand the Polynesian Village, the golf resort, and the Walt Disney World Village resort area. We also have in design 3 hotels. And the first one we talked about earlier, the Mediterranean, will be located between the Ticket and Transportation Center and the Contemporary. The Cypress Point Lodge, which eventually mutated into Wilderness Lodge, will be built west of River Country and will be themed as a Western hotel. And again, you know, that no idea dies at Disney. It will include log cabins along Bay Lake. So
there you go.
But here we go. The third one, the Grand Floridian, will build on the old Asian site on Seven Seas Lagoon. It'll be a replica of a great Florida hotel of the 1900s. Our creative people have come up with an absolutely beautiful design. And again, like we said, this is where, you know, at the top of the show, this is where he wanted to build those honeymoon cottages. But the next one is the one that just sounds tantalizing to me. In addition, we have some dreams for the Walt Disney World Village. What they wanted to build from the Empress Lily, you know, again, where Fulton's Crab House is now, we're going to build a New Orleans Street, and you'll be able to walk from there right into a beautiful New Orleans hotel.
Wow. So it could have been Bourbon Street at Downtown Disney, walking into places to stay in. How about that? You can kind of walk over there now for Saratoga Springs because they've got that pedestrian, you know, they're building.
You can.
Wow, that's interesting.
But yeah, that, you know, and you have to wonder how much of the design that was done for that was pulled from, you know, wound up being used for Port Orleans and Riverside.
Yeah.
Anyway, to sort of, to, you know, to bring things full circle here, Epcot Center opens October 1982, and given that this educational theme park went over budget and never met its initial attendance predictions, that forced a regime change at Disney. And once Michael Eisner comes through the door in October 84, one of the very first things he was tasked to do was find ways to bump up the Walt Disney World's on-property room count. And so he's, you know, then goes over to Imagineering. He's looking over everything that they've planned but never built. And he points at this giant white model and goes, "What's this Grand Floridian thing?" And for the rest of that story, folks are going to have to wait a couple of weeks, because Len and I actually have to go down to Orlando, and, you know, we're going to be doing a walkthrough over there and check out the hotel, you know, go over the Grand Villas, wander over the Wedding Pavilion. And I promise you, we've done we did a walkthrough of this place 2 years ago, 3 years ago now?
It's been 4 years, Jim.
Oh, dear Lord.
Time flies.
Okay. Well, I promise in the research phase that I've come up with a whole new slew of stories that we didn't touch through during our walkthrough. And forgive me for reaching this far back to do this joke, you know, going to the bungalows, but I promise we won't Bora Bora you. and that's it. So.
Fantastic. That's great. It really sets the stage for the rest of our podcast over the spring. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. Please go on to iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care.